Mr. Bendelit D'Souza, Rear 13. Mr. D'Souza, would you like to tell us how did you come across Bahau Settlement, the news about the Bahau Settlement?
Well, I heard about it from friends first, then from my own members of the family. I decided that it was a good idea, since you know, there's a chance, because I'm an outdoor man actually. I like doing this sort of thing, although I've never been a farmer, so-called, in all my life. It's something nice for me to learn. I'm a bit adventurous, and I said it's a good idea to myself. Why not go? There's a brother of mine, a little older than I, who I tried to persuade, but he didn't like the idea, because he was thinking of a lot of things that he couldn't get there. I said, never mind, you come, we do not know what's there, or if we have to get, if it means getting rid of that habit, okay, we get rid of it. He didn't. But then, as luck would have it, he was taken as forced labor by the Japanese to a place in Bonya called Jesselton. And there he was detailed to carry, to bring a truckload of explosives in the lorry. And then the lorry exploded, and he died. They only found his belt. And, well, if he had come with me, perhaps it would have been okay. So then I packed up, and I went to the Cathedral of the Good Shepherd on a certain day, and we were packed into lorries and went to the railway station. I just had a few things of mine, you know, a toothbrush, soap, and a few clothes, slippers and things like that. And, well, we went up there. And the train journey was very slow because we had a donkey train. It was very, very slow. But being a happy-go-lucky chap, each time we stopped at any station, I used to get down and play with the little Indian boys who would come down asking for money. Of course, those days we still had 1 cent. And I could speak a little Tamil those days. Now I can speak a bit better. And all the people in the train were just laughing at me. Look at Ben. He's always with his children and all that. But we arrived in Bahau, and it was raining. And we got down, and where we could, we helped each other to carry the things. I helped my mother, because she was old, carry her things. And we were taking a lot of breaks, because the place was full of slush. It was really, really muddy. And just imagine traveling more than 5 miles in a man-made path, road, not path, it was a kind of a road. When we arrived there, it was dark, just dark, just arrived, you see. Darkness had just come in, and we were just said, okay, told you go and stay in this communal hut. I think there could have been easy about 50 over people sleeping on what we call bali-balis, one flat row of things, and you put your whatever you had on it and slept there. There was nothing to eat. We didn't bring any food stuff, but we were more thirsty and hungry and dirty. So we got down to have a wash. And the next thing I knew, I was dead to the world. And the next morning only, we were told to fall in. for our breakfast. It was all done communally, you see. We had some cooks there who cooked for us. And whether we liked it or not, we had to take it. Whether it was sweet enough, it's up to us. And this went on for 1 or 2 weeks. During which time, I contracted malaria and I was very, very bad. We had a makeshift hospital there. I was put in there. I came through. But not long after that, I met some boys who were... Well, my mother was already down at her place. You see, I met some boys who asked me to share with them. I said, okay. So that's how I went down to share with them.
And but your journey to Bahau, can you tell us a little bit more about what was the conditions like in the train?
Oh, we all had a seat, and because our barang-barangs, luggage were put either on top or beside us or in the passageway. You see. There was no such thing as being checked every time, you see, by the railway wardens. Because we all one community bound for one place. If they did stop, it was to pick up some mail on the way. It was a donkey train, you see. And maybe one or two coaches had some places for one or two people, that's all. But it was a long wait, you know, a donkey train, you had to wait for all the other trains to go by before you can make way. Well, I made it happy. Jokes and things like that. We made ourselves happy. We just dying to see where we were going to. We thought we were going to the Garden of Eden, but it was a garden of hell. And it was quite a pleasant journey.
You didn't go with your mother and sister, did you?
In the same batch, yes.
But I thought you did not register with them.
No, I didn't register with them. So that's why they had their own plot. I had my own plot.
Why didn't you go together?
They must have heard of it first and registered first, you see. So those days we didn't have any computer to find out whether we were related or not. So when I registered, I was given a separate form, a separate plot when I arrived at Bahau, which meant I was supposed to till that ground all by myself. All things being equal, that would have been the case.
How much money did you have with you when you went to Bahau?
Japanese currency? I cannot remember. But I know I had sufficient money to give the little Indian boys on the way at each station.
Were you worried about the farming techniques, which you had none?
No. And the reason was because we were told that we'll be taught. See? And well, I was quite good with the hoe and the rake. I used to do it as a young boy, and before that, as a young man. I just loved outdoor work. So I said, oh, I'll just be taught the ropes and it should be all right. You see, tell me when to water it and where to get you, how to dig for irrigation. You know, all those things. I said it should be okay. But we didn't know what was in store for us. We were miles away from irrigation. We were miles away from anything. But it was rich, virgin soil. That much I'll say. Good for certain things only. You couldn't plant rice there for one thing anyway. It's not lowland.
And how long was the journey to Bahau?
Well, I think it couldn't be more than 4 hours.
By that time you arrived in Bahau town, what time was it?
It was dusk, past dusk, isn't it? And it had been raining, so it was dusk, and it was, well, I remember we arrived there were lights on, and must have been, well, I put it this way, all in all, the whole journey, from the time the train moved out till the time we arrived at Bahal, could have been about 4.5-5 hours. Definitely. Not more.
And you arrived at the Bahal station. How did you go from the station to the settlement?
Walking.
Walking?
Walk. We had to walk. They carried the heavy luggage for us by truck.
Who were they?
The people who went ahead of us in the first batch, who were the organizers and things like that, they arranged. The heavy baggage was put into the trucks. Because I didn't have a heavy baggage, so I had to carry it. And the rest of us had to trudge in sloppy slush all the way there, including my mother.
What was the road condition like?
Horrible. It was man-made road, that's all. It was not tarred. All mud. And there were many slips. Many people did slip and fall. Clothes were all dirty. But since we knew we had a certain distance to travel, and that was all, it was okay. You know, mind over matter, we didn't mind it so much. But if we were told that it's going to be, we're going to have a break in Bahal and then in a certain way and sleep the night there and then go somewhere else, of course that would have made it worse for us. But we trudged along and we reached there.
Which batch was yours?
We were batch number 5.
So what time, roughly what time did you arrive at the settlement?
Going by Japanese time, it must have been about 8 p.m. 1.5 hours difference. About 8:15.
What was your first impressions of the place?
Oh my goodness. Is this what we have come to? We arrived at night, so we couldn't see what it was like, you know, in the bright. So it was the first impression was that we are going into a kind of a dump. Nothing. There were no electric lights, all gas lights, and we had to sleep on one big bunk sort of thing. The place was all slushy. It looked as if we had come to a prisoner's camp. Only thing a little better, that's all.
And were there some people there to welcome you?
Oh, I won't say we had a welcoming committee there, or party. But we did have friends there, and one or two the people in the first batch did tell us where to go and all that. They didn't come and cuddle us and say, "Hey, welcome, Ben. Welcome. It's nice to see you." That sort of thing. No, they must have been in a bad state themselves.
You mentioned when you first arrived, you were allocated to some huts. Communal huts. What was the sleeping arrangement like?
We had to sleep, as I told you, on one big communal bunk. You see, what Malays call it bale-bale. You see, you just put your mattress there and you sleep there.
What about the females?
The females were separate.
So it was a kind of a long,
something
like a longhouse hut.
And it wasn't tidy, neither was it clean. But it was, it was It was just organized. It was an organized place, that's all. But it was not like what I was used to in the army, you know, you get yourself trimmed up and clean and neat and all that. It's like a longhouse. I haven't been to a longhouse, but I think a longhouse is cleaner.
How many longhouses were there to accommodate?
Well, if I remember correctly, two for the men and two for the ladies. Because the earlier batches had already found places to live in, you see. They must have built their huts very quickly, or they had someone to build for them. Yes. Some people had, those who had the money, had people to, paid people to build their huts. You see, we didn't. We did it ourselves.
And other facilities in the communal area, like a kitchen,
we had a communal kitchen down below, run by our people. Where the toilets were concerned, it was very unhygienic. It was a bit of an open place, and you did your whatever you had to do there, and we had to now, that's something I can't give you in detail. Oh yes, we had to go quite far for it. And if I remember correctly, it was down a slope. So we had to throw water after we'd done a long call, throw water to flush it down into some place or other, I can't remember. I think it was a kind of a big drain. And eventually, at the end of that drain, where it couldn't go anymore, couldn't flow anymore, it was covered up with earth. No flush system.
And at the entrance of Bahau settlement, was there a sign or something saying that this is Bahau settlement?
Not that I can remember. I don't think. The very sight of the people, you know, you had arrived at your destination. And on the right was the admin part of it. And on the left were where all the men were settled down. On the right, we had the women, which was quite near the convent. We had a convent there, you know. And the priest's house. Well, actually, it was called the priest's house. Then after a time, the convent moved over to the left-hand side.
On your journey to Bahau, was there any Japanese to sort of guarding this batch?
No. We didn't have anybody. We had our own men who looked after us. They trusted us.
And you said that when you arrived in Bahau, you were given a place to sleep, and then the next day, what were you supposed to do on the next day?
We were supposed to report to the office, and they would have told us what to do. And where our plots were and all that. So we did that, and as I told you earlier on, we joined the Pathfinders. Because without the pathfinders, we wouldn't be able to, we wouldn't have been able to find our plot. And that went down for a week or so, 2 weeks. And then we found out our plot, and then not long after arriving there, I chummed up with these friends of ours, and we lived in our hut down below.
Mr. D'Souza, would you like to describe to us about how the land in Baja was allocated to the settlers?
As far as I can remember, we were just allocated the land just like that by the people who had gone ahead of us. You see, we went in number five, I think the word is group. You see, so the people who went before that had obviously got together and planned these things out for us. You see, they must have had people who were involved in this sort of thing, you know, in this sort of organizing, and they must have allocated as they came. And if the person didn't come, well, the land was just left bare. So ours was, if I remember, mine was E9, I think. It was just given out to us, you see. And we went over, had a look at the place, and found out that there was a lot of difficulty finding our way there to begin with. So we had what we called, I didn't give this to Leiling, pathfinders, some hefty big Eurasian chaps, you know, who were really tough. They knew the ropes, they had their own axes and saws, and well, we joined that group to make a path to, well, right up to, I can't remember now whether it was E something or other, and since we were involved in that and I wanted work, we followed him. He was the leader, you see, so he used his common sense and experience by finding out the shortest route where there were less, you see, when we went over there, they had already felled some trees, huge trees, well, huge to us in Singapore, and there was space underneath it. Okay, we'll worm our way there, or we'll cut our way through, and it was very difficult, and you had to know the technique, you see, because you saw one part, and then that one goes down, your saw is going to get caught halfway, or less than halfway, and then it's going to be difficulty. But he and some other people had the experience, so we just cut our way through that one log, you see, and then, of course, hacked through the undergrowth, made a path, and with our chunkos, made a nice little path. And we used to work to, I think, about 12:30 our time now, not that time. And we call it a day because it's be really killing. And if we, well, you know, we had to go back and to attend to other things. So we used to work as early as possible from 7:30 our time up to 12:30, 1 o'clock. And finally we built a path to as far as the place was opened up. Okay. And that didn't take long. As far as I can remember, it took about 2 weeks, or 2.5 weeks, and we completed that side of it. Because the earlier people had already done the land on the right-hand side, perhaps that it was already quite clear, you see. But ours, on the left-hand side, was not clear. And but we took, I would say, 2.5 weeks to 3 weeks.
Just to build the path?
Just to build a path. And I tell you, it's no joke, because the mosquitoes and the heat, and we had no water. Oh, we had no water there. We had to bring our own water. Normally, it's to be Chinese tea or coffee or water. Just that.
And how far was that piece of land that you got? How far was it from the communal huts?
Well, as the crow flies, well, you know, we had what we call the main road. We go down the main road, say about quarter of a mile or less than that, and about quarter of a mile in. But that quarter of a mile in meant windings and things like that. And it's okay during the day, but at night after heavy downpour, you should be afraid of snakes. You see, but we make sure that we were home early if we were alone, or if we were in a group, then we didn't mind. If you take, use sticks and, you know, bang, hit the trees and all that. Even then, we don't know what we're going to expect when we reach home. But it was quite safe. We were not harmed by anything, except by leeches, only when we were digging it. But we had, what do you call those high boots? It was quite okay. It's only our arms. Let's pull it out. Nothing much. Just lose a little bit of blood, full of malaria, so why worry?
And did you build a house on your land?
Well, you see, my mother and my sisters were staying separately. I joined up a gang of boys. And there was, well, two little French boys. Then there was Albert, Andrew and Oscar. With me, there were six. Eventually, the two French boys went away, came back to Singapore. I can't remember why. So the four of us, we had one chap, I think he's gone to Aussie now, Oscar Campbell. He was the brains. OSCARCMBPBELL. Campbell, Oscar Campbell. He was the brainwave, and he was the brains of everything. So we used to go after our so-called breakfast in the morning and leave it to him to spot, say about six, eight or eight inch circumference trees, you see. Okay, cut. And we had already been taught how to cut and make it fall where you want it to fall. He was quite expert, you know, thanks to him. And, okay, after felling one or two like of those sort of trees, we used to, you know, cut up the branches and put them one side. And then put it in such a way that when we come back for the second or third one, we will know where to find it, number one, and it won't be difficult carrying up. Because it wasn't easy. See, after felling, after pathfinding, the path was not that straight, you see, or winding. So it was difficult, and it was a hell of a job. Just four of us, we used to take turns. If it was heavy, we'd have two in the center, one in each end. Then you bring it to our place and let it, and you take a rest and go back and get the other one or two. And that used to take half a day, perhaps. Then, of course, came the measuring of it and all that. But anyway, we did a very good job out of it, thanks to this chap. teamwork. And eventually we built a house with a veranda. It was a... we had something below, you know, it's a kind of a... you can say it was built on stilts, more or less, huh? But we had a little room, a storeroom downstairs, and we had a veranda, and we had two rooms. And we even built a kitchen. And many people were very, very, very surprised. Thanks to Oscar. Oh, but you fellas gave a hand there, but it was his brains. And, of course, in the interim, when in the evening... not so bad. After a so-called tea, we used to clear the garden, you know. At the same time, make way clear and build and till certain parts for our tapioca. nuts, which used to grow very easily. Sweet potato grow very, very easily. And I don't know the English word for kangkong. Now there are two, if you're a cook, you'll know there are two types of kangkong, land and water and land, you see. Well, the easiest, well, if we had a stream near us where we used to get the cross, sometimes fully water, or the other one was just land. And that used to be our daily food practically. It used to be tapioca, which I didn't, which I never liked, and I still don't like it, but I had to eat it. Kangkong, sweet potato, and we'll make, I was supposed to be the best cook there amongst the four. Eventually all learned, and Bengalan wants to cook today, we will see what it's like. We'll find the difference the next morning.